Meeting on the state of the Oregon Health Fund Board. And if I can call the director of the Health Fund Board to the podium. Thank you very much for coming, Barney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You got your show on the road here? Is that
right? Pardon me?
You have your show on the road? Is it a road show?
I have done this on occasion in the last few days here in this building. For the record, my name is Barney Spade. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Fund Board. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before the committee. The information that I have in printed form for the committee really includes two aspects of what I was going to cover today. The first is a brief PowerPoint to give you an update on the status of the board, how it has been organized, and how it's pursuing its work, a picture of the timeline ahead. And the second is a report that has been delivered to the legislative leadership pursuant to Senate Bill 329, which is an update on the work of the insurance exchange. There's a provision in Senate Bill 329 that calls out for a report to the legislature. And I thought, with your indulgence, I'll cover those topics. I'd be happy to take questions along the way, so feel free to interrupt me, and if I have a senior moment, I'm so sure the chair will remind me of whatever I missed.
Well, and sympathize.
Thank you, sir. Mm-hmm. Let me start with the progress report. Senate Bill 329 directs us for the board to report to the Legislative Assembly on the progress in developing a comprehensive plan to decrease the number of children and adults without health insurance, to ensure universal access, contain health care costs, and address issues regarding the quality of health care services. So this is an oral version of that report. Let me back up a little bit. Senate Bill 329, as you know, was passed by the 2007 legislature, I think in late June of 2007. I joined the governor's staff on July 29th of 2007. The governor appointed seven members of the board in mid-August, and the Oregon Senate confirmed those members in mid-September. And the board had its first organizational meeting on October 2nd. I would note that there was great interest among Oregonians in the board. There were over 125 persons that submitted interest forms for appointment to the board. I'll get into talking about the committees of the board. We had over 200 people that were interested in working on the various committees that the board has established. As noted in the third slide there, it is a seven-person board, appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. The statute lays out that a majority of those seven members cannot be involved directly or indirectly in either providing health care coverage or involved in the financing of health care coverage. Our board is chaired by Bill Thorndike from Medford. Mr. Thorndike is the CEO of Medford Fabrication and has been active in a number of public policy issues over the years, including K-12 reform, workers' comp reform, works with the Oregon Coalition, Oregon Business Coalition, AOI, and OBA. Jonathan Ader is elected vice chair. Mr. Ader is principal of Ader Wynn, a law firm in Portland. And in the last two or three years, Jonathan has been active on the Oregon Health Policy Commission, which helped develop a document that the board is using as a point of departure, and I'll cover that in a couple of minutes. Eileen Brady is the other vice chairperson, chairwoman. Ms. Brady is the co-owner, co-founder of New Seasons Market in Portland, and also a board member of a small business, so she brings the perspective of both purchasing health care for large business and also for overseeing in a governance role a small business. Tom Chamberlain is the president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. We have one provider on the board, Dr. Chuck Hoffman, Dr. Hoffman's from Baker City and has been in the leadership of the Oregon Medical Association for a number of years. Ray Miao is from Bend. Mr. Miao is a retired research scientist from the Stanford Research Center, has lived in Central Oregon for, I think, going on 15 years, and is the current statewide president of AARP. And then lastly, Marcus Mundy is the CEO of the Urban League of Portland, and has been involved in healthcare administration indirectly over the last few years, primarily in the area of HIPAA or the privacy areas. So that's the board. The next page, slide four, I indicated that we got organized on October 2nd. We used the meetings of October 30th, which was a full day kind of mini retreat, and November 6th to bring the board kind of up to speed on a lot of background information, characteristics of the uninsured in Oregon, characteristics of cost increases. We had over the last few years, we had a person present from the Commonwealth Fund, where they have actually an interesting scorecard or comparison of the 50 states along certain performance dynamics. So we use that as a background briefing opportunity. On December 12th, the board met conjointly with its delivery system committee to hear about the state of primary care in Oregon, and also this concept that I think probably many of you have heard about both last session and even in this special session, the concept of a primary care home and a new model for primary care delivery. We met on January 15th to hear some more background in the area of mental health. We have a meeting scheduled for next Tuesday. And as you can see, we are scheduled through April, and when I get into the timeline, you can see that they're going to be very busy in the May, June, July time frame, and I'll talk a little bit more about the meetings in the fall. The committee is organized around six committees, and five of them are fairly well called out, not so much by their name, but by the functional area of policy that they're working on. And I'll quickly go through the six and who the leadership of those committees are, and then talk a little bit about the charters that the board developed for each of the committees and give you a little understanding of at least where they are. We have a benefits committee. On this slide, the number in parens is the number of people that are serving on the committees. So we have 14 members of the benefits committee. It's chaired by Susan King. With the Oregon Nurses Association, with Dr. Saha from the Veterans Administration, and also on the Health Services Commission, and Nina Stratton, an agent broker in Portland. Those latter two are vice chairs. We have a 19-person delivery system committee chaired by Dick Stenson, who's the CEO of Quality Health Systems in Hillsborough, and then co-chaired by Mary Beth Healy and Dr. Doug Walta, a retired physician from the Oregon Clinic. An eligibility and enrollment committee of 15 members, chaired by Ellen Lowe. As many of you probably know, Ellen has been involved in healthcare policy reform for decades or more, and also serves in a distinguished capacity on the Health Services Commission for 16 years. And Jim Russell from the Mid Valley Behavioral Health. Federal Laws Committee is chaired by Dr. Frank Baumeister. Dr. Baumeister is a gastroenterologist, practices in Portland. Past president of the Oregon Medical Association and Speaker of the House, and probably most notably, I think one of the interesting perspectives that Dr. Baumeister brings, that he was the only Oregon participant in the Wyden Hatch tour of America, where they listened to Americans over, I think, 30 or 40 meetings across the nation on healthcare, and so he participated in that and found it to be a great learning experience. Ellen Gradison is with the Oregon Law Center, and she is the vice chair of federal laws. Our finance committee with 17 members is chaired by Carrie Barnett, senior vice president with the Regents Group and the former director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and John Wooster, who is in the leadership capacity with Oregon Steel Mills. And then lastly, but not least, is the Health Equities Committee, chaired by Ella Booth, an ethicist at OHSU, Joe Finkbonner with the Northwest Portland Indian Health I always get this wrong, Health Services Commission, and Tricia Tillman with Multnomah County Public Health. You can see we have about 100 people engaged in these committees. The rosters of these committees are available at our website, and I would be happy to make them available to each of the members. They are very diverse. We've put together a very diverse, on all of these committees, very diverse group of individuals from the private sector, from advocates for coverage, from employers community, from the insurance community, the agent broker community. I'm both proud that we had so many people that were interested in serving on this, because these people are putting in untold hours of committee meetings, and I'll get into what the pace is for the committees.
Brian, excuse me.
Yes.
Representative Gelson?
Thank you. On the Health Equities Committee, amongst your 16 members, I notice in the leadership there's efforts to address racial inequality and probably economic inequality through the Public Health Department. But I'm wondering if you specifically have folks on there to talk about physical disabilities and chronic illness and developmental disabilities, since that community is very concerned about where health care reform is going to go and whether or not their Correct. Lives might be in jeopardy if we have lists of organized care.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, the membership of the Health Equities Committee includes people from representing communities of color, ethnicity, disability, rurality, and sexual orientation and gender. And so it is broadly, we tried to make it broadly diverse, and so we do have representatives on the committee from representing the disabilities community.
And follow up?
Yes.
Do you specifically have both someone from the physical disability community and someone separately from the developmental disability community, since those are very different interests and needs?
I'll have to get back to you on that. I can't answer it directly.
Thank you.
I'll give you the membership list and determine whether we meet that standard.
Okay. Thank you.
The committees, with the board getting organized in October, and we organized the committees in the October, early November, the committees really got launched in early November. And I did on our website, I try to do a monthly update, and we closed the year out, I think, in the months of October, November, and early December, because we did have the holidays. We had something like five board meetings, four board meetings, and 15 committee meetings. And I think there were 13 scheduled for January, and we're into another similar month in February. The work of the committees really is very intense in the period of time that I just mentioned historically, but also up through probably the end of April and early May, with many of the committees meeting at least monthly. Many have some work groups, and in some committees they're actually meeting twice a month, and as they get near the deadline that we have given them to have some initial recommendations ready for the board in late spring, they will be meeting more frequently. I just have to point out again the spirit of Oregonians relative to volunteering to be part of this process is incredibly encouraging, and this could not really be done without a professional staff that can put together a meeting and meeting minutes and do the professional staff work and then get ready for the next meeting that might be as soon as 3 or 4 days later. They've been working real hard. That's the general overview. Now, with your indulgence, I'll talk a little bit about each of the committees and what they're looking at. The Benefits Committee, and these are summaries of charters that are, in some cases, two or three pages long, but I've tried to summarize those. And the charters for the committees are also available on the web, and I can make those available to each of you if you're interested. The Benefits Committee is charged with defining a set of essential health services that would be available to all Oregonians under a comprehensive reform plan. And the makeup of the Benefits Committee includes both representatives of the Health Services Commission, who have been involved in some cases several years in the development and continuous refinement of the prioritized list used in the Oregon Health Plan Plus population, and other members from either advocacy communities or from the private sector, where clearly something other than a prioritized list is generally used in the commercial market. And they're looking at both, they've spent a lot of time understanding how the list was developed, what the hierarchy of the list means, how it compares or crosswalks, if you will, to commercial coverage. We're developing a tool that they can use, and they will be going through a process over the next couple of months of really trying to target, either by a combination of a list or other mechanisms, this concept of what's essential, what's less essential. And that's a tough job. I have to tell you that I've been involved in this business for 30 years, and we've looked at basic benefits, essential benefits, whatever term you use. It's a challenging job to try to answer that question, and I commend the Benefits Committee for the hard work they put in and what they're going to be putting in. Yes.
I have a question on, thank you, Mr. Chair, on how this actually is going to work, because very quickly a benefits committee could end up becoming a wish list where advocates say, well, you've got to have this, you've got to have this, and so forth, and that's completely disassociated from the financial aspect of it, and it could end up setting the whole process up for failure, because if you're talking about defining a set of benefits that are going to be required for universal access to health care, cost becomes a huge issue. And
it does.
So I'm interested in how does the committee actually deal with basic benefits versus what is basic as defined by a set of advocates who feel like their areas might be more basic than others, or certainly would want to assure that there ultimately are mandates to cover certain things.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, you've touched upon, I think, a very tough part of this job, and I would describe the process so far as follows. Really, right now, they're looking, I think, at what I would describe as in a much more categorical area without a lot of financial guidance on this issue of essentiality. I've discussed with the chair of the committee and with the committee that ultimately the board will be looking at the issue of their definition of essential against financial targets of reasonableness of what's possible, and at minimum I would hope that the Benefits Committee's work will give the board a sense of priority or hierarchy. This is a totally hypothetical, but we will be doing micro simulation modeling, and we have an consulting actuary with us. But if you look at, quote, a comprehensive plan that through a Medicaid delivery system might cost $350 a month, this is just round numbers for an adult, with this set of benefits, but the board ultimately is looking at revenue strategies or other approaches where that's much too high. We will probably go through a series of modeling when you back down from that number, what the both net expense and net against any kind of revenue projections, and really look at the input from the Benefits Committee as far as what's not covered when you have to meet certain, and it may be benefit design issues, like things may not be fully covered, there may be limits. They're also clearly interested in policy aspects of not just what is covered, but how it's covered. For example, the use of evidence-based medicine as standards of coverage, the use of integrated systems to improve the efficiency of coverage, the introduction of new technologies and how those are rolled out. So they'll be giving us, if you will, some policy bases to look at this. But you are absolutely correct, and as a member of the Ways and Means Committee, I think, understand that at the end of the day, the judgment that the board will have to bring to bear and its suggestion or proposals to the 2009 legislature will have to balance this issue of desires, needs, and capability.
Marnie, that leads to a question that I have as well, and that's, you don't have to answer it now, but as you work your way through, I just sort of imagine you get how many committees?
Six.
Six reports, unrelated to each other, some unrelated to reality. some heavily anchored in reality. And then the fund board has to do something with those six. And do they see their task as sort of scotch taping them together and dealing at the margins, or are they going to take those as input and produce a whole new thing out of it?
Let me address that, because I think one of the process issues that I've been asked about, and the board and the committees are asking about, is, you know, what is the process of integration? I'll tell you in the context of the question that Representative Richardson asked, they're really the work of three committees interrelate very closely. One is the eligibility and enrollment committee, the other is the benefits committee, and the third is the finance committee, which ultimately brings all of these things together. Clearly, there's going to be at some point both an interdigitation at the committee level as they get closer to looking at final recommendations. But the board, what we're hopeful for, and what staff is trying to both work through the committees and provide, and ultimately provide the board, is that there, in most of these policy areas, there's a wide range of perspectives. In some committees, the range of perspectives may be much more narrow, or there may be even consensus. But I know, for example, on the benefits committee, there's a wide range of differences about, just in the discussions to date, about what's essential and what's not. In the eligibility committee, which was charged with looking at some standards of affordability, for example, for premium assistance for people up the income scale, there may be some differences of opinion about how you subsidize persons along that income scale. We're hoping to bring, and I hope, I'm going to say stronger, we will bring to the board from that committee whatever range of policy discussion they had, so that the board is fully informed of what that range is all about. The direction or the recommendation of a committee, I would determine right now, and the board is ultimately the determiner of this, is really it's up to the board. But I want to make sure the board understands where there are, you know, differences of perspective and opinion, and they will. So it's not going to be a scotch tape per se. But they will have to balance some of these issues, particularly around the cost access issues. Now, let me deal with a couple of other committees that are not so directly involved.
Senator Boone, did you have?
No.
I hear somebody gasping. Is that you? Yes, Representative Gelzer.
That was me. Oh, sorry, you calling on?
Yeah, if you want.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's okay to be interrupting you.
Yeah, could I just finish one thought before I lose it? I mean, we have the Delivery System Committee, which is really looking at the cost containment issues that are applicable across the system, not just in a publicly sponsored program. Those will really fit in at the end as a set of recommendations that, you know, that Oregon needs to achieve these on cost containment, whether it happens to be a state-sponsored program or an employer-based program, of how do we get greater value out of the delivery system today. And then the last one, which fits but is a little tangential, and that's the Federal Laws Committee, which is charged by statute find where federal policy may inhibit the state from achieving these goals, so that we could inform the congressional delegation of the findings of the committee and ultimately of the board.
Like ERISA, for example.
Actually, it's called out explicitly in the statute some areas, and we've added to it by some outreach and conversations, but clearly looking at Medicaid policy, Medicare policy, ERISA, EMTALA. We'll be looking at HIPAA. We'll be looking at tax policy. Federal tax policy does not treat evenly people who buy or provided health insurance. There'll be a number of other areas that we'll try to bring together in this. Here's federal policy. And we're asking interest groups, stakeholder groups, state agencies to comment on what federal policies, not so much in an administrative rule, but, for example, a good one is Medicaid policy still built around a 40-year-old categorical definition with all sorts of waivers. It's a strange system that may need to be have some revision. So that's an example. So those will fit into the final recommendations, but they're not quite so integrated, or the necessity for integration is not quite so direct. So sorry for that long answer, but I wanted to get it out before I forgot it.
Thank you, and I'm actually glad I waited. I appreciate the presentation that you're giving and the complexity of all of these issues. And my biggest fear about healthcare reform is who we lose in the process and who loses access to necessary life-saving or life-sustaining treatments. And I'm concerned that in talking about all of these pieces that are essential, that that Health Equities Committee did not factor someplace in there. I think it's important to remember that when we are talking about a prioritized list of what might be offered through a public program, in the context of this whole idea of reform, we're talking about basic health care that would be available to everyone through some sort of a system. So maybe not just people who are relying on a public system for health care, but are purchasing private insurance as well. And when we try to figure out what works for 95% of the population in terms of basic health care, that other 5% could quickly get lost and their lives could very much be at risk. A good example, a person with a physical disability could need treatment for what for any of the rest of us might be an inconvenience, a cold or a respiratory illness or a flu. For that individual, going untreated could very well cause them to die. So I very, very much hope that the perspectives of those who are currently categorically eligible for Medicaid and who are struggling to get access to needed health care even when they have insurance are considered as you move forward, and that these things aren't kind of at the bottom in the one committee that's left off of the presentation, but that their needs and their health and their value is equal with everybody else in the state of Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser. We have representatives of the disability community on almost every committee that's not isolated to health equities. Catherine White is on, I believe, the Eligibility and Enrollment Committee. We have representatives. They may not be direct receivers or parents or family members, but representatives of the Oregon Law Center. I think this issue of the wide variation in healthcare needs across the population is inculcated in the membership of every committee. I guess what I would say is I feel confident that those kinds of issues will in fact be addressed and discussed at the committee level and ultimately brought forward to the board in the same spirit that I think a lot of the work that's been done in the state over the last 20-25 years acknowledges just exactly what you described.
And I appreciate that. I think the fear that is out there in communities, partly from where this conversation has ranged, starting with Governor Kitzhaber talking about quality of life and referring to things like breathing assistance and feeding tubes, when there are many people who have a tremendous quality of life who have disabilities that require those things.
I've been there and
understand those issues. Affirming that value,
right,
moving forward and always keeping that there, because it's scary for those that look at access to health care that they have. Might they lose it in the process to get something that's standardized for everyone?
I agree with you.
And I certainly argue quality of life is a critical issue that needs to be defined specifically to different people's lives.
Right, and I would submit that the people that are part of ADAPT or Not Dead Yet probably have a very different definition of quality of life.
Absolutely.
Than any of the rest of us, and those are the groups that should define their own quality of life. We shouldn't superimpose that upon them.
Yeah, the problem isn't about thinking about quality of life. It's thinking about it in a stereotypical way that doesn't apply to the whole population.
Exactly.
Barney, thank you again.
Yes, delivery system. This committee, I think, has probably one of the biggest tasks that I know many of us have been laboring for decades in. How do you create, improve, develop a high-performing healthcare system that contains the rate of cost growth? Some would like to see cost roll back. If in my lifetime I can see the cost curve change by a few percentage points over a decade, I think that would be a great, great improvement. But also looking at quality, efficiency, and value. Let me provide a context, and I think this committee, I'm sure, is aware. There's a lot of evidence, particularly across the nation, about the variation in healthcare quality, the performance against national clinical benchmarks, wide variation in cost with no seeming outcome difference in mortality or morbidity. This committee has been handed through its charter to really tackle some of these big issues. And let me highlight four of the areas that the board asked them to look at. One is the whole issue of primary care. primary care in this country, but in this state, is in a crisis on almost every front, from a workforce point of view, from a burnout point of view, from a reimbursement point of view. So they're looking at this from the perspective of how do we revitalize primary care, how do we incent new models of primary care, and I'm certain this committee's dealt with the issues around primary care home. The board and the delivery committee are looking at that both from the perspective of publicly sponsored programs like the Oregon Health Plan, but also from commercially sponsored programs, because there's a great interest among the purchaser community, the employer community that buys 60-65% of the health care for Oregonians. Are there new models that can improve particularly the management of chronic disease? And I think there's growing evidence. I don't want to. I have said that I am a true believer by faith in this, but I believe there's very strong evidence that strong, multidisciplinary, aggressive primary care management of chronic disease over the long term is cost effective. We avoid preventable hospitalizations. We avoid more costly specialist care, et cetera. So, and we have on the delivery system committee representatives from the third-party payers, from major provider groups, from publicly sponsored, fully capitated health plans, of looking about how can Oregon create an environment that over the next few years, both the public and the private sector working together and through basically reimbursement reform, is to incent the development of new primary care models. And it's going to take really a concerted type of reimbursement reform before you're going to see the innovation happen, because there needs to be a tipping point of enough business in a particular, I hate to put it that way, but there's a business model here that has to be created, and it's going to take both the public and private sector. That's one area. And that's really targeted at the substantial amount of money we spend every year in chronic disease management. And we know where we spend the money. And we also know that where I think the weaknesses in the current system don't allow us to be able to invest resources better, to have better continuity of care, et cetera.
Jesus.
Yes.
Representative Maher.
Thank you. First off, your comment about the disparities, and you said it may not impact morbidity. I would say that the disparities do, in fact, support the theory that more is not better. And so I think you can just say unequivocally, we know that more is not always better.
I don't disagree with you, but you mean the disparities in expenditure?
Disparities in expenditure.
Yes. No. I always try to be careful. There are people that still don't necessarily agree with that, particularly if they live in Florida, New York, or Southern California.
Or Louisiana.
Yeah.
Your comments about primary care, I think, are right on, and about the reimbursement model are right on. That our delivery system is a function of how we pay for it, and the only way you're going to change the delivery model is to change how you reimburse for services, and so I really appreciate that. But I'm going to skip just a little bit. There's an assumption that's been stated several times. It showed up in the December update from the Health Fund Board, and it talked about the individual mandate. And if you want to address that later, I will wait. But I want to go ahead and say it now, Mr. Chair.
I told Mr. Spate there are several issues that I wanted to alert him to that he'd be asking about. And it is good to have that, so he can either answer it now or he can think about it.
I can answer it now.
Okay. Is that there is a, in this process, there's an assumption of an individual mandate.
Well, can I correct you?
Yes, sir, please.
The way I would characterize it, Mr. Chair, Representative Maher, is the following. The board is starting with what I've described as a point of departure, is the Oregon Health Policy Commission's recommendations, which include an individual mandate,
okay,
and the Oregon Business Council's recommendations, which include an individual mandate. That does not mean, I do not want to leave anybody with the impression that necessarily the outcome that the board reaches after we do due diligence on an individual mandate, which is an incredibly complex transition, one way or the other, that is a preconceived endpoint in their deliberations. But we are starting with those two documents as a framework of looking at a longer-term reform, and I would hope that out of the discussions and public input back from that is that there may be other choices looked at also.
Okay.
Now, I hope that's responsive, but that's how I interpret it.
And I appreciate that, because yesterday I had a conversation with, and I don't want to say a name, but a member of the subcommittees who told me that she has been told that the individual mandate piece was there because, and I'm not attempting to be partisan here, but because the Republicans insisted that it be there. And I can unequivocally say that, and I picked up my jaw off the floor and said, I can't believe you're serious. And she was serious. And I said that absolutely not, that in fact it would be quite the opposite, that would be our default position. And that this individual mandate, just the words individual mandate, become very politically charged and is a very difficult hurdle to get over. And that it's the conversations about how to frame that. It's not about individual mandate. It's let's talk about personal responsibility. And quite frankly, that Edmund Hasselmeyer yesterday, asked him three different times this question. He's a Heritage Foundation.
I've read his work.
Okay. He kind of turned that conversation around and said, well, it's not individual mandate. Let's talk about personal responsibility and attack it from that angle. And so I'm cautioning you.
I'm not sure I speak in the Democratic caucus, but I don't think that would be the caucus position in either caucus.
Okay. And it's just those are, there are some words in this building that are very politically charged.
And I just want to reiterate, Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, our use of the term, the conceptual framework and within which that term is used, from my point of view as senior staff and from the board's point of view, emerges from both the work of the Health Policy Commission and the Oregon Business Council, not from any kind of partisan perspective one way or the other.
Okay.
That was HB 3368 or something. Barney, let me ask you a very similar question to about the underlying assumptions. Every bill we looked at, every bill we considered when we were talking about reform of the healthcare system, including 3368, took as an assumption that we could make basic changes in the way healthcare is delivered, and that those basic changes were almost essential to be able to get where we need to go, the same system, the same cost 10 years from now, more system, less cost, whatever those assumptions were. But the time frame of the kind of proposals that must come out of that delivery system committee is not likely to be consistent with the time frame of the plan. I mean, it would seem to me.
Time frame of the what?
Of whatever plan you're going to produce. And, I mean, if you're waiting to produce a plan that will have some certainty about basic changes in the delivery system, I think it's going to be a harder plan to develop.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to be naive about the recommendations that come out of the delivery system. If we are serious about changing the delivery system, that's not going to be a set of recommendations that, even if the Oregon legislature agreed with the board, that in a year or two-year time frame, that delivery system will change. This, in my mind, and this is my personal opinion, is that the board's recommendation on a comprehensive plan should be a 10-year vision, because it will take us it will take us a minimum, if we did it right and a concerted, and we had a vision, a strategic vision that both public and private policy could move toward, is that our delivery system, whether it be at the state of Oregon or nationally, is far too complex to change reimbursement models that lead to the change in the underlying. It's going to have a sequential approach, and it's also going to have deep coordination between what public purchasers, like the state, you're the board of directors of the state of Oregon, and private purchasers want to invest in as far as those changes. So it's complex, and I think it's longer term. But I think there is a the interesting thing in my career, and you precede me as far as when you got started, Mr. Chairman, there is more discussion of innovation and changing clinical and business models now than I've seen in a long time, and a seriousness on the part of private payers, private purchasers, and the government to support those changes. I think there's a realization, and Representative Maurer, is that, you know, we have a delivery system that is modeled exactly the way we pay for it. We should not be surprised by what we've got. I mean, it is a market. It may not be particularly efficient, and it may not be delivering the product or services that we particularly want.
But it delivers the product and services that it's designed to deliver.
Right. So, I mean, the awkwardness, if you will, of the comprehensive plan is going to be some of this is going to have some kind of, and I keep using the term staging or sequencing, some of these recommendations are going to have a much longer life for implementation and impact, and others maybe shorter. But I believe that the seven members of the board do agree on one thing. And I think most of the private purchasers that I've talked, and I really come to this job more as a purchaser, notwithstanding my peripatetic background, is that cost is the fundamental issue. We are not going to have a sustainable public program or private program without getting something done on bending the year-over-year cost curve. And I talk to businessmen, regardless of the size of their business, whether they be internationally in the traded sector, deep concern about whether it's sustainable from their point of view. And similarly, whether you're the governor of the state or the mayor of a city that buys health insurance coverage, the sustainability from taxpayer paid issues is a big issue. So that's why I the delivery system I look to, and it's tough. And you also know, at the end of the day, if we get into some areas that are truly transformative, in 2009, you all better get ready, because when you change the business model, someone's going to lose. Or, if we do it right, everybody's got to lose something.
Yeah, all I could caution you, though, is the statement that if something can't possibly happen, it's not likely to. And it seems to me we can't build reform of the healthcare system on an absolute promise that we could take a magic wand or a hammer or a checkbook and instantly reform the delivery system.
Right.
Because it just isn't going to reform.
Follow up? You are exactly correct. I mean, it's just everybody's nodding their head saying, yeah. So can we wash our hands and say we agreed and reached consensus?
Well, I think to say we don't need to find a way to reform the delivery system.
I wasn't here in 2007, but I think that probably the reason the board was created and I was foolish enough to take this job was, in fact, there's hopeful that maybe there's a community of interest that in between sessions there can be, you know, there can be some tough discussions had, and we'll bring something back for due deliberation by you elected representatives. You know, the interesting thing, and these are your side, and if this conversation is useful for you, it's therapeutic for me.
It's very useful.
I talk to just about everybody that's involved in this process, whether it be the CEO of insurance companies, the administrators of hospitals, physician leadership, businesses of all size, state policymakers, folks in the executive branch responsible for budgets. Almost everybody says the system is broken and unsustainable. I mean, privately, they just, it's all, you know. But what we're trying to do is create an environment where, okay, if it's broken and it's unsustainable, what are we going to do about it? We're just going to either wait for D.C. or we're going to wait for implosion. Is there a way that we can begin at the state level to make some movement that changes this? I mean, do we have any control over our destiny as a community or not? And I think that's going to be the huge challenge in all of this for the board, and really the board's got the easiest part of this. because whatever we do, probably whatever the board comes out with in October or November of this year, there are going to be thousands of people who don't like it, and then you all get to confront it, because we'll throw it over the transom, and it'll.
My only recommendation about implosion is that I was absolutely certain the healthcare system would implode when it reached 12% of GDP. President Cannon.
Mr. Chair, talk about control over our own destiny. One part of our destiny that we don't currently have control over is Medicare. How confident are you, and not to reopen old wounds, but how confident are you that we can bend this cost curve as a state over time in some sort of gradual way via changing reimbursement and thereby changing the delivery system? How confident are you that we can do that without being able to change Medicare?
Bend the cost curve without losing money, because we did.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, that's an excellent question, and I understand a little bit about the history behind Senate Bill 329. Let me address it this way. A lot of people have told us, that without kind of Medicare on the table, you're not going to get anywhere because of the Medicare cost shift. And I think many of us have been working as a high-performing Medicare state with folks from Minnesota and Iowa and Nebraska and all these other states that are suffering under the same kind of Medicare policy. And to some degree, I would agree with you, but I would point out the one difference that I think offers some opportunity is that we have the highest penetration rate of seniors enrolled in Medicare Advantage plans than any state in the union. Almost 40% of seniors are enrolled in Medicare Advantage plans, and these are either Medicare HMO type plans or Medicare PPO type plans. Generally speaking, when I talk to both providers of care and those who sponsor these plans, is that the reimbursement is better in those plans than it is in Medicare fee-for-service, because actually the rates that are paid are a derivative of how well the plan utilizes care, the happiness of members to stay enrolled in those plans, et cetera. One of the strategies that we'll be looking at is that, we're clearly, the Federal Laws Committee will be sending another message to the feds about under reimbursement in this state. But I'm also very interested to understand, is there a way at the state level we can actually incent or somehow grow the number of Medicare Advantage plans? My experience in the state of Washington when I was purchasing health care for about 400,000 folks was that there was a movement of foot in, and I'll give you two examples, of Olympia and Tacoma, where very well-organized provider IPAs were getting into the Medicare Advantage plans because they found it, from their point of view as a provider group and also for their patients, that it was, they could manage the risk under that plan, and that may be an intermediate-term solution. The only other point I would make on this is that we may be getting some support. The Commonwealth Fund just released a report a few weeks ago, kind of the 10 messages to whomever the new administration is or the new Congress. And one of the points they made was that some of the Medicare fee-for-service policies are in fact discriminatory to high-performing states. We have a low APCC. We have historically had a low, average adjusted per capita costs, in large part because we were a highly well-performing state 15, 20 years ago, which everyone said is great. If Florida did that, just think, we wouldn't have a Medicare problem. What's happened is Medicare reimbursement policy and fee-for-service has been uniformly applied across all states, whether they're high-performing or low-performing. And there may be some emerging understanding, because we're not alone in this. I mean, there are a number of states that the use and the cost of health care services over the last 25 years in Medicare are widely variable from these other communities. And that may give us some intermediate-term relief if we could get things like that happening, along with what I've mentioned on Medicare Advantage.
There is another element in Representative Cannon's statement, which I found interesting because it flipped it on its head when I heard him say it, and that's that he was talking about getting the cost curve under control, And one of the problems with Medicare is the statement that it only pays 87% of our costs. The implication being we need to raise Medicare reimbursement rates. The other implication is we could reduce costs 13%. And then it would cover the costs. And I'm not sure quite how we find the way to do that, but system efficiencies could help the Medicare problem even without changing Medicare reimbursement. It makes the system more efficient.
I would note as an aside, Mr. Chair and Representative Cannon, a member of our board who serves on the board or on the governing board of a hospital system indicated that kind of a major eight consulting firm at a recent retreat, they were asking about kind of the strategic management issues over the next 5 to 10 years. And he said one of the messages that was most, I suppose, disconcerting was you need to learn to manage your institution in the context of existing and projected Medicare reimbursements. And that is, and this is what I hear in conversations between businessmen and healthcare providers, that's the biggest disconnect. And it goes something like this. In my business, I am forced every year to look at the internal cost structure of my business and try to find efficiencies, because if I don't find that, some business down the street or soon to be down the street will put me out of business. We don't have in our healthcare delivery system and perhaps even in our financing system the same kind of incentives, in large part because of the way we finance this, that if you find a dollar in cost savings through clinical redesign or business redesign, you actually get that to the bottom line and the purchaser wins simultaneously. And that's kind of, I think, one of the biggest problems around this reimbursement redesign is how do we incent and reward innovation? And not penalize innovation, because in many cases we don't have bad people in this system, but we have a system that actually I think right now is a perverse disincentive to find innovations, because the revenue is going to be taken away from you.
Yeah, APCC just pays,
right.
But
just in Medicare, but across the board.
If you tell me somebody's paying me 40% of my business and they're paying me less than cost, I got to find a way to make the cost right for that 40%. And you just can't avoid that. Senator Richardson?
Mr. Chair, just...
Let me just do a time check before we do that. We've got about 30 minutes, and we're interrupting you, and I think this conversation is a very useful one, but we also want to leave room for you to talk about where you're going on the exchange design, the other part of the report. So,
very briefly, your comment about lowering costs certainly is true if you have the opportunity to control that, but the providers are the ones that control the cost. The reimbursement is controlled by the government, and so when we say we're going to give 87-85%, we really just want you to lower your overhead by 15% so that the 85% will meet 100% of your needs. That there's a disconnect there, because
if I've got three people in my office that are doing insurance billing, if I can find a way to do things so I can cut two of those three people out,
reduce
my costs.
The exchange,
there are ways to try and find ways to reduce costs. Reducing costs doesn't always mean reducing my salary.
No, although you get back to incentives, which is going to be the key, because ultimately for this to work, I believe you're going to have to come up with a system that is so attractive that the flow goes to it. You're not going to be able to say, okay, in Oregon, as of January 1st, such and such year, we're going to change the way everything's done, because the pushback will be so great that it'll get stopped some way. But if there's a plan that's designed in a way that says, look, you can continue in many ways the way you're doing business, but if you buy into this model, it will make life easier for you. You won't have to have so many people chasing down the insurance. The payback will be easier. The administration will be easier. You'll be incented. You'll get paid for having healthy people and not merely paid on procedures and numbers of sick people that you deal with. And all that, I mean, changes the incentive so that there's a natural attraction to it. Then something will happen that will be really positive. Making that happen is going to be a real challenge.
I agree with you completely. That's the model I'd like to help build.
Bernie, how about moving to your last slide on timetable and then moving into the other part of
your
report?
As I indicated earlier, the committees are working now and will be working up through April, probably into May. And in some cases, for example, in the earlier discussion around benefits eligibility and finance, working conjointly with the board, maybe a little later than that. We are hoping to have a draft a set of recommendations that the board would, again, it would be in a draft available already sometime in the June, early July timeframe. I mentioned to the chair that I am here to ask either for forgiveness or permission. I made this same statement on the Senate side. The due date of our report is October 1, 2008. I've indicated that I think that we're going to need another 30 days for the following reason. The original timetable and milestones that I set up for the board really puts us into public outreach in August. And I think it would be much better to take a set of draft recommendations out and do, and we've got a lot of partnerships going on to do kind of an extensive public outreach, but also an organizational outreach through the whole myriad of organizations in the post-Labor Day period, which takes us right up to October, and then the board would use the month of October to take all those comments in and make any revisions so that we'd have a final report on or about November 1. We'd certainly make, for the purposes of process, a draft report available on October 1. But I, your colleagues on the Senate side, they thought the public input in that post-Labor Day period would be valuable both to the process and perhaps ultimately to the 2009 legislature.
Well, let me put something into your bonnet in this one, and it was the same issue that I tried to raise with the Health Policy Commission. That October deadline is there because of the pre-session filing deadlines in the committees of the legislature, and there was a hope that we could get stuff ready for pre-session filing of bills so that when we came in January, there were things in front of us. It would be very useful if you coordinate as we get closer to that, both with the committees that are likely, and there are three interim committees, I think, that are involved in this, but certainly the subcommittee in the Senate and this committee, and work with the ledge councils so that when your report came in a report form for the public and that people could read, there was simultaneously a set of legislative concepts that came with that would be consistent with your report.
And contemporaneous,
so that we could make...
That is our plan, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Madam Chair, when's our pre-session filing deadline for things? Is that... I think we need to have it out of a November meeting in order to have it available.
Well, may I interrupt?
Yes, please.
Senate Bill 329 provides that the board can go directly to legislative council.
That's right.
And absolutely. Not go through the governor's office.
I forgot that.
And so what I would like to do as we get more meat around recommendations in some sort of written perspective is to work with the interim committees, but also to at least get where the board, and it's really the board's decision about, I think the legislation says something to the effect to introduce legislation that the board deems necessary to affect its recommendations. A lot of our recommendations may be we urge public-private partnership, et cetera. But to the extent that the board wants one or more bills introduced, we're hoping in that September, October, November timeframe to coordinate with legislative council to at least get some placeholders, and we fine-tune it after we get the final report. So that in addition to a written report, there would be a vehicle around which to have a discussion.
Good. Okay.
Okay.
Next part.
Mr. Chair, the next document you and your committee have is dated February 4th. The cover letter to the leaders of both houses. As I indicated, Senate Bill 329 and the introduction here lays out that the board was asked to present a plan for the design and implementation of an exchange. Before you read any of this, the first thing I'm going to tell you is it doesn't provide a plan for implementation or operation. The complexity of this issue and both the timing that's available. What this report does do, it lays out some background about health exchanges, that I won't spend a lot of time on. It gives a little bit of background about the Massachusetts Connector, which is the one public exchange that is operating now. Tries to point out the differences between the Oregon market and those in Massachusetts, and why these market differences are an important part of the thinking of looking at the role of an insurance exchange. And then talking about the role of an exchange in broader reform. I'll take responsibility for this. I asked the exchange work group of the Finance Committee to think about the exchange first as a tool in the context of broader reforms. An exchange necessarily in and of itself doesn't do a lot, but it does potentially play a significant role in the context of other reforms. And so you can see here that some of the assumptions, and this may lead to some more colloquy around the individual mandate, but with an individual mandate and with subsidies for affordability to the individual mandate, there are substantial changes that would come to the individual market. Right now, the individual market is a voluntary market, and one of the reasons we have medical underwriting and we don't have guaranteed issue is because it's a voluntary market. People can come in and go out of their own accord. In the context of a reform market, this points out that, in fact, the work group is saying to have guaranteed issue and not medical underwriting, and then how would the market reforms change relative to carrier behavior in this new marketplace, and then in the context of that new marketplace, what potential role or roles might an exchange play? And the report goes on. The work group has identified some potential goals for an exchange. They're noted on pages 6 and 7. And I think that the heart of this, as far as suggestive of the, where the work on the exchange work group is right now, is they're really working across three potential different models, and they're listed on page 7 and 8. One would be a model that's called Tier 1 that would be an exchange that primarily provides information, enrollment, and administration. If you can think of this as an exchange where most of all of the carriers are inside the exchange, and people use the exchange and the technologies that an exchange can bring to make choices. The second tier is an exchange that has a more active role. In addition to those above in Tier 1, it could establish some comparable benefits, create some performance benchmarks for carriers relative to cost, network adequacy, evidence-based care, et cetera, establish the role of insurance agents and brokers in serving the exchange and its customers, et cetera, and that if a carrier met those requirements, the carrier and the products would be inside the exchange. And then finally, at another extreme would be the exchange actually does all of one and two, and then actually does soliciting bids or price proposals, negotiates with carriers, and selects both the carriers and the products that are inside the exchange. This is a range of policy options for an exchange, and this is where the work is right now of the exchange work group, is to evaluate all three of these as a potential, and this could be an evolutionary approach, but to develop kind of the pros and cons and implications of any of these three models. I would note before closing on this is that the other aspect of the exchange that needs to be considered is who is forced to use the exchange and who is not forced to use the exchange. For example, I think there's general agreement among the work group that anybody receiving a state subsidy would use the exchange because the exchange is an excellent vehicle for improved administrative efficiency of subsidies. But is there a parallel voluntary market? Is there a parallel market that others can use? Is there not a parallel market? Can people choose between the exchange? These are some complex issues, particularly relative to the marketplace, to make certain that the exchange isn't set up to
with adverse selection potential or vice versa. So these are the kinds of fairly technical issues of envisioning a new marketplace and the role that this animal called an exchange would play. And I'd just highlight, I was at a recent conference where somebody from the Massachusetts Connector was there, and they used the connector both to help get folks into their Medicaid managed care plans, but also it's a voluntary choice for those that don't have subsidies. They've enrolled about 15,000 people through the connector in the non-subsidized program, but their market has grown 85,000 outside the exchange. They have a parallel market with the rules established so that there's no kind of gaming between carriers. So it's interesting. They have 100,000 more people in coverage through the commercial sector, and only 15,000 use the exchange, but the others are using. Now, they haven't analyzed it a lot, but I was taken back by the size of that enrollment in the commercial. These are not government programs. So a lot of these choices about how to set an exchange up, what its role would be, would it be evolutionary? Another issue that we know that would be of interest in the exchange, beyond the individual market and those with subsidies, what about small business? Could small business use the exchange? Can all business use the exchange? And I think you may have heard, I'm sorry I could not make those meetings, but I've read the paper by the esteemed gentleman, and that model, everybody uses the exchange. And so there are market transformation issues across this whole gamut, and that's kind of where we are. And so, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in a few minutes, that's my summary of 9 pages. It lays out some of the questions that they're having. They continue to work, having meetings tomorrow with the exchange work group, and we're hoping by sometime in April that the Finance Committee will have some recommendations from the exchange work group about this issue.
Representative Richardson, or Representative Maurer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Barney, thank you for this update. The concept and the opportunity of the exchange is huge for Oregon. And I mean, the idea of being able to have insurance policies, I mean, I like the idea of having all the policies be available through the exchange, because what it does, if it was organized correctly, it would be that the state is allowing a way for comparisons to take place without forcing people to select one or over the other. And we'd even have the opportunity for the state to organize plan 1, 2, or 3 or whatever, and have different levels, and as long as it could deal with the pre-existing condition issue. And one way that was suggested yesterday, which you're certainly aware of, is you do that through longevity. If a person has been covered for X number of months, then they're less likely to get coverage just because they have a sickness coming on. And if they stay covered for a long period of time, they could be benefited as well, because that continuity of care helps assure that they're not going to game the system based on current.
And actually, we have that now under HIPAA, that if you are continuously covered, you can move from carriers, and if you will get, I think the term was used 10 years ago, get credit for good behavior.
Right, and so I could see that if you have this set up this way where people can go, and you add to this transparency as far as utilization, you know, hospitals and what they charge, where things are going well, ways, you know, people that are successful, so that people could find out and rate the kind of care that they're going to get from going different places. That's kind of a subset of this whole thing, but have a knowledgeable utilizer. And then you have an exchange where people could get valuable information, and they have options of not having to go through the whole sales thing, but to accept, you know, what one of the plans that the state has set up for them that they could have if they, you know, qualify, and if based, you know, it would be means tested or whatever for income and all of that. I think there's tremendous opportunity that way, and I'm really excited about seeing us look at this carefully.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I am too, and I'm particularly because I was involved with Rocky King and others in helping design FEOP, and FEOP, I think, holds. It's a model that Oregon, I think, can successfully build on, of assisting families of modest income with premium assistance. What we need is as an efficient administrative tool to be able to do that, and also to do it in such a way that people can move somewhat seamlessly. I hate using that word because it's always the design thing, but, you know, I don't think there's anything that's seamless in my life. But the idea is that there's not a lot of barriers, that if your life circumstance changes, you can, you know, your healthcare coverage can move with it.
Portability, so, certainly. Would
portability, yes, right.
No, and my only comment to that is that I would say the public employees need to be the first group to sign up, because that's going to be a very easy control to make sure that this thing works, because they've got a lot of support in order to do that. And I you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander in this case. And so I hope that we're not saying, well, this one group cannot play because they're in a different realm.
Representative Cannon.
Well, that's sort of along those lines. I wonder, my reading, very quick reading of this report, suggests that it's primarily focused on the individual and small group markets, and there's less attention to the, or less kind of desire or interest in creating an exchange that would be used by large groups. Help me understand why that appears to be the assumption that underlies the Massachusetts and potentially Oregon exchanges.
Chair Representative Cannon, let me respond this way. And a lot depends upon how you want to define large group. One of the advantages that an exchange brings, particularly to a small group, and let's define that as under 50, but even more probably astoundingly is under 25, is generally there's only one choice of plan. Generally, a small employer only has one choice of plan. When you get into larger groups, whether they be public employees or private employees, there's oftentimes at minimum two choices, and in some cases even more than that. And so the first perspective of the exchange from a kind of theoretical and conceptual point of view is it does allow a small employer the advantages of, say, an Intel or the federal government's choice, where you get two or three or four choices without any of the additional burden at the small employer level, because it's done within the exchange. The issue of the attractiveness of an exchange to larger employers, particularly, let's say, jumbos with 1,000 employees or more, I think it's going to be kind of a test to see whether they are. Interesting comment, though, that I'd make in that, and the folks on the work group, which include insurance executives and agents and brokers, and I think this echoes perhaps some of the spirit in Representative Richardson's comment, is that if the exchange does add value and does good work as far as doing the administrative thing, making choices available, et cetera, it should be an attractive option that others would want to use, and it should live or die based upon that value added and service and efficiency, et cetera. And so I think it's much early in the concept of an exchange to actually see what larger businesses would like. I would just note out factually, Massachusetts has not opened its exchange up to small business yet, but I think they're intending to by the middle of this summer. So that'll be interesting to see, because in Massachusetts, under their model, a small business continues to be able to buy in the regular market or to buy through the exchange. And that's going to be very interesting to see how many small businesses find the convenience of an exchange. Because in essence, what a small businessman does is, I'll make so much contribution, and I'll do the 125 pre-tax, and you go to the exchange, and you decide from the menu of coverages that are available what fits you as an individual or a family. And that's I think it's a very elegant. I think it's a very elegant model.
Barney, I wonder. I have two questions, and one is a kind of technical question, and the other is not. You have three tiers of exchanges, and I can imagine a fourth and fifth and sixth, as I my imagination.
You're trying to keep it simple.
So, well, I was asking, to what extent are the people on that committee who are completely rooted in the existing health insurance system likely to create a model that flies away from the existing health system? I was involved in the design of the Israelis' national health insurance program, and because of some very perverse things in their system before, they got into the question of shouldn't what amounts to an exchange be able to gather all the premiums together in a single place in an exchange and then distribute them on the basis of risk adjustment, which deals with the question of adverse and selection. So if this health plan structured itself to get the really sick people, fine, money comes with the sick people, and if you provide health club memberships with your health plan aiming to get the people for whom that's really something, then the money flows based on the risk of the insurer you're getting. Is there any possibility that we can be thinking about those kinds of
actually,
things?
Actually, Mr. Chair, in the discussions of the work group, we are looking at both what I would call internal risk adjustment, that is, the premium would in essence follow the risk profile of the population that the plan attracts, because even if you have the same benefit designs, some plans by either brand loyalty, network makeup, or something might in fact attract a higher risk population, and there are ways
that should be okay.
And there's some support for that concept. We used it in the state of Washington for 15 years among the plans in the Washington PEB, and the model. I mean, it kind of works. So there's that. There's also the issue of how you deal with the individual market in a reformed way of perhaps looking at some form of reinsurance, because remember, in a reformed individual market with guaranteed issue, we have to transition away from the high-risk pool, where we now are incurring about $80 million a year of subsidy from other insured folks. And so there's discussion about how do you do it, how do you manage that risk both between carriers that are in the exchange, but also the higher-risk population. There would be some normalization of the population as you brought more people in, but you're still probably going to have some folks that have very, you know, very high costs, and are there ways to spread that evenly? So they are looking at that. To your earlier question, which I will put in crass terms, have we invited the fox into the hen house? Having been a fox and a hen, the first thing I would say is, A lot of this is very technical risk management kinds of issues. That's one. So we need the expertise of the agent broker community, the insurers. I think secondly is I've been involved in the carrier community in Oregon off and on. We got some progressive thinkers. Third, I will tell you, any of this does change the marketing and distribution systems of an industry. And that makes people nervous.
I
heard a term recently from a CEO that disruption causes innovation. I don't know whether they view this as just standard old disruption that will lead to innovation or not. But they are working very consciously about thinking about, one, how do you move from this market to a new market? Because there's a big transition issue here. And then how do you have a stable market that is stable both from the employer-employee point of view, but also stable from the carrier's point of view, is that we don't want to create a design in which we either force carriers out because they can't, you know, they've got a death spiral in medical loss ratios. So this is really thoughtful, and I will say on the other side is that the board is very interested in hearing about this spectrum and probably going to ask some tough questions of, are we being bold enough? I mean,
that's
the interesting challenge that you've all given us is that I'm told repeatedly, be bold. But you know, when you're bold in a market, You got lots of people that don't want people to be bold, but you want them to succeed in a new market. So we need their counsel and their expertise and their, I think, buy-in to a vision of boldness.
That's the issue. It's not the fox in the hen house.
Okay.
It's if I've done something the same way for 25 years and made little changes to the market, and I'm not likely to be the one who's going to say, let's move to a whole new thing. And I just want to make sure there's enough people in the mix who are willing to say, well, wait a minute, let's forget all these assumptions that you have inbred in you.
Right.
You don't think about them. I don't have that assumption. Let's talk about X.
Mr. Chair, when I talked to him the first day, I said, I'd like you to suspend judgment. I'd like you to not think about the market you're thinking about today, but think, how would you work in a world that looks something like this?
That you reinvented.
And that you've reinvented, that there's a role for private carriers, et cetera, et cetera. How would you make that work from a point of view of risk selection, risk management, fairness among carriers, eliminating or mitigating cream skimming and all that other stuff?
And my last question, and I think it'll probably be the last question we have today, you and I looked at page 9 of the draft I have, and it's the page that talks about your plan for February 29th, but it talks about how you're going to do a comprehensive plan, too, and that includes ensure universal access to health care. Is that still on the board? I mean, does the board have that clearly in their mind, that that's one of the things they're absolutely trying to move toward?
Yes, time? I believe, and I believe that, again, building off the work of the Health Policy Commission, I believe that we will first try to take a financial snapshot of to cover 600,000 people with some form of coverage. What would it cost? Is there a staged approach to do that? And I haven't spent any time on, and you probably already know, the facts that of the 600,000, 60% are below 200% of the poverty level, 30% are below 100% of the poverty level. We have mechanisms in the design of the Oregon Health Plan with Managed Medicaid that I think offer themselves if we had appropriate stable funding and appropriate expense management over a long haul to, if you will, move incrementally or in a stage process forward. And I think they have this vision of, we want to get to that. I'm not certain. I don't want to speak for them, but I'm also a realist. I don't think they're going to give you a plan that says in 2009, like
press
the turn of a...
Press
this button and universal coverage will be there. But I think they would... I would hope, again, they're an aggressive, smart board, is to say, here's the vision, and are there steps we can take over time to get there, and how would we, as seven people, suggest to the legislature to do that?
Yeah, my last comment is, I suggested to the committee working on 329, the selection criteria for the seven people on the board is that you would test the extent to which they could follow a star in the east and end up in a manger with a child being born. Wisdom is really, and in fact, I think we ended up with a board that can be characterized by being wise people, and that's a really important thing. Franny, good luck on your journeys. Thank you for coming here with us.
Thank you. And
keep
Mr.
in touch.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I do want to stay in touch. I'll get you all web-based addresses and things, and I don't know what the plans for the interim are, but either individually or collectively, I'd be more than happy to give updates to you as we move through this, because I think it's very important that you understand how it's evolving, and I would particularly appreciate the personal counsel from each of you as I try to help do this.
Yeah, I guess the test of the success of the plan is the extent to which we can get it enacted in the 2009 legislature.
That's it. That's it.
Thank you very much.
Or
thank
some
you all
good
for being
part of it.
We, just to remind you, we're not going to have a meeting tomorrow. Thursday we'll be dealing with a report from the Oregon Drug Purchasing Program and the Senate Bill, what number? Senate Bill 1062. I'd like to get them both done on Thursday because I promised to try and get you Friday off, and I still am very much committed to trying to do that. And that bill should not be too complicated. It's the bill that you might take a look at it before you come. It's the gut and stuff of the bill we jointly heard with the Senate committee, but it basically expands the, well, it takes away, I guess, a drug formulary for nurse practitioners and gives them the full prescription privileges that a physician has. So it'll be something to look at. We'll have some testimony. And thank you very much. We'll see you Thursday.
Yeah.